You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Sergeant and Mrs. Smith, you're going to love this house.
Is that a tub in the kitchen?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Robert Schneider, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication, 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to Routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 30, the 1981 production of Dreamgirls, and with us today is the author of that chapter, Tony-nominated librettist and lyricist Bill Russell. Mr. Russell is an internationally produced playwright, lyricist, and director who received Tony Award nominations for the book and lyrics of Sideshow. He co-authored the book and lyrics for Pageant and has directed that show in the Fringe and West End of London and many productions around America. He's also directed Elegies for Angels, Punks, and Raging Queens, for which he also wrote the book and lyrics, around the United States and in the Fringe and the West End. Other book and lyric credits include Unexpected Joy, The Last Smoker in America, Brave New World, and the Texas Chainsaw Musical. Bill, it is such an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Bill, my first question for you is why is Dreamgirls a key musical?
Dreamgirls is a key musical because it opened Broadway to a new sound and to many people of color who went on to become major stars, though they were unknown when the show opened. And I do think it ushered in baby boomer music or music that appealed to baby boomers in a way that Broadway hadn't seen before.
And when we gave you the list of possible shows that you could choose from, you chose Dreamgirls. Why did you want to tell this story?
Well, I have a personal connection to the show. When I first saw it in previews on Broadway, I was absolutely electrified by the show, but especially by Henry Krieger's music. And I immediately thought, oh, I have to write with this guy. And I did go on to write four shows with him, including Sideshow. But that didn't happen immediately by any means. My husband was a critic at the time that Dreamgirls opened, and he reviewed it, and he was often invited to these special symposiums about the whatever show they were for, and they had the whole creative team of Dreamgirls there at one of these luncheons he was invited to, and I got to go, and that was the first time I really saw Henry. But then 2 years later, I met him in a television studio in Los Angeles. He was there for the LA opening of Dreamgirls, and I was with a comedy team I directed, and we talked for half an hour, and it was fantastic. And I kept thinking, God, I would love to write with him, but I didn't have any ideas at the time. And he was working with Tom Ion, who wrote the book and lyrics for Dreamgirls. And then 10 years after that or so, 9 years, Bobby Longbottom and I were talking about the Hilton sisters. He had seen a movie they had done, a terrible movie. And he said, we had discussed it for several years, but never gotten to it because we were doing Pageant. And he said, well, we should do those twins, that twin musical, and who should we ask to write the score? And I immediately said Henry. And that launched us on our collaboration.
What is it about Henry Krieger's music that spoke to you when you first saw the show?
Well, my musical influences were much more rock and roll than musical theater, really. And I always, when I did start writing musicals, I really was interested in writing rock musicals. I was inspired by Hair. And so Henry's music just, I mean, it had such energy and such drive. And that's what really appealed to me about writing with him.
And what impact did Dreamgirls have on you that in terms of its construction or in terms of its performance style that you still take with you today when you're crafting a musical, whether it's with Henry or with somebody else?
Well, it had a fluidity. I mean, the staging was often called cinematic, Michael Bennett's staging, because he did use a lot of techniques that really came from film. There's this wonderful moment in Act Two where Effie she's the lead character in Dreamgirls, she's making her comeback, and the spotlight came in on her. She's trying out in a nightclub, and the spotlight came in just on her face, and then it pulled out, and she was in a completely different costume and dressed for performance. And it was like a close-up in a film and then a zoom back created on stage, which is not easy to do. Also, the whole production danced. Even the set and lights really danced. Everything moved. Robin Wagner, who also designed Sideshow, and I got to know after Dreamgirls, but had a lot of questions about it with him, had designed these lighting towers that were the basic set, and these lighting bridges which lowered and rose. And it was just in constant motion. The towers all moved, the lights moved. That kind of dynamic is very exciting. It's very visceral on stage.
And could you define for us a little bit, what exactly is the baby boomer generation, of which you are so proudly a part of? And that's what right. Music did your generation listen to that was popular at the time? Some examples.
Well, baby boomers are generally defined as being born after World War II, 46 to say 64. And hit songs, so many big hits for my generation came out of Motown, which is what Dreamgirls really tapped into. And that was thrilling to audiences. I mean, there had been Ain't Misbehavin', which was Fats Waller, which was really an earlier era of music, but it did, it was a big hit, won Best Musical. It brought that music to a much wider audience because it was so commercially successful. And Dreamgirls just upped that even further. I mean, it really, Henry has a great ear and a great sense of, he loved that music. He grew up with it. You know, I grew up in the Black Hills of South Dakota, which was not a theatrical hotbed and not where Motown was played on the radio a lot. But even so, I was still really inspired by those songs. And I think audiences, that kind of rhythm and blues beat was something that my generation was very familiar with.
How did Henry Krieger and Tom Ion meet one another and start this collaboration?
Well, Tom had a show playing off Broadway called The Dirtiest Show in Town. And Henry was doing some press for it. That's how they met. And then Tom wanted to turn that into a musical called The Dirtiest Musical in Town. And it didn't happen immediately, but at one point he called Henry and said, can we just spend an afternoon together and see if we can write together? And they did, and that worked out. And Tom was already thinking about a musical about backup singers, especially Motown, you know, that whole era, the Ronettes, the Shirelles and of course the Supremes, which, you know, many people say Dreamgirls is based on. I don't know so much based on, it's certainly inspired by them.
Tom Ion is one of these individuals that, like such a long list of other individuals that we lost too soon. He passed away of AIDS at the age of 50. Did you ever have the chance to meet Tom Ion? If not, what are the contributions that Tom Ion made in his short time on this earth to musical theater that you might still see being used today?
My very first Broadway experience, which never made it to Broadway, but I worked on this musical Brainchild, which had a score by Michel Legrand and Hal David. And there was a stage manager on that who was really good friends with Tom Ion, but I don't think I ever met him. And of course, by the time I started writing with Henry, he had passed away. I think, well, his contributions, certainly with Dreamgirls, there was a kind of storytelling. I mean, they much of Dreamgirls was sung. And Henry is so good at making recit sound like conversation. He really can do that so well. And much of Sideshow, especially the initial versions of it, were sung through, and we played with that a lot. And I think Tom Ion with Michael Bennett found a fluidity, as I spoke about earlier. Somebody has said that musicals are all about the transitions. You know, if you can nail the transitions, the musical will work. And that show, the transitions were just absolutely seamless. You were never aware of them because it was always constantly in motion.
And, you know, when you were doing your research for this chapter, was there anything that you came across that surprised you that even you were did not know?
Oh yeah, some of the last minute changes they made. I mean, because they had done several workshops. A workshop is when a show is put on its feet, usually in a rehearsal studio, often fully staged and choreographed, but without costumes or sets or lights. And it gives you, well, because taking a show out of town, which was the standard way to develop a musical for many decades, became prohibitively expensive. And so Michael Bennett with the Chorus Line developed the workshop idea of just working on the material. And I think it's actually a brilliant way to do to develop a musical, because there are so many parts involved. And I find, as a writer, just hearing my stuff is so helpful. So we often do a number of readings, and then we'll do a workshop ultimately. They're not cheap, and you know, but they are very helpful. And so they had done a number of those. Then they took it to Boston. And it actually opened in October of 1981 in Boston. And it opened on Broadway 2 months later in December. So, I mean, that never happens, first of all. Yeah. You know, it was a miracle that they could get a theater, for one thing. It was easier back then before all the mega hits started running for 30 years, you know, and tying up all the theaters. And it was a Schubert House, and they were in a Schubert House in Boston. So they came in right away. But they added, they replaced Effie's song One Night Only, and I forget what the other one was called. But I was surprised by that. Also, they brought in Harold Wheeler, a brilliant, brilliant orchestrator who I'm happy to say I've worked with three times on shows with Henry. And he's African-American, and he absolutely understood this music, Henry's music. And they brought him in. That was late in the process also. So things like that kind of surprised me. I really didn't know.
By moving to Harold Wheeler, did somehow the orchestrations become more authentic?
I think they did, yes, because he really knew that musical genre, those genres. I mean, he's multi-talented in all sorts of genres, but, you know, he told me once he started when he was 14 playing trumpets in strip clubs and in St. Louis, and his father would take him to work, drop him off, and then come pick him up, you know, late, early in the morning after his gig. So he really understood that kind of music.
Can you give us a little bit of the cultural impact that Motown had on popular music of the time?
Well, it was huge. I mean, the music industry was divided into black music and white music for decades. And there was a whole, you know, record industry and touring aimed at black audiences, but there was very little crossover. And of course, Elvis synthesized that. He took the black sound and sold it to white America, basically. And Motown then happened around that, the height of Motown happened around that time. And I think because of Elvis, white audiences' ears became more attuned to that sound, and they started discovering all these authentic black artists. So I think that's kind of what happened.
Would you walk us through a little bit of, if you know, how Dreamgirls changed from its original workshop process, of which there was many? It wasn't just one workshop, right? And off we went.
Not at all.
Like there was quite a bunch. How it changed from those first couple of workshops to eventually what audiences got to see in December of 81?
Well, I think when it started, they, you know, Tom had always wanted to write about backup singers. And I'm not sure how much of a script there even was for that first workshop. I think he had the opportunity. Joe Papp at the Public Theater gave them the workshop before they really had a show. So there was a lot of stopping and starting and discoveries along the way. And eventually, I think the story became clearer. Effie, in the original version, the original workshop, disappeared at the end of Act One. She never came back. And in fact, Jennifer Holliday quit at one point because she didn't appear in Act Two. And there was a lot of, I mean, they originally wrote it for Nell Carter, who had been in The Dirtiest Musical in Town, and they had written a song for her that stopped the show. And then she got a soap opera first, and they were going to do another workshop, and they didn't want to wait for her. Jennifer had made her Broadway debut in Your Arms Too Short to Box with God when she was 20, and I think they all went to see her in that and then invited her into the process. And she, you know, she was young and volatile, and there were a lot of issues, but they were really sold on her. But then she quit at one point, and Michael Bennett kind of wooed her back.
It's so interesting because when you think of Dreamgirls and you really think of Effie, it's so hard to separate it from Jennifer Holliday because it feels like the part was just custom made for her the way, you know, a perfect dress would be made. But to know that Nell Carter was the original inspiration, let's imagine that we had a time machine and you got to see Nell Carter. Could you imagine what you think Nell Carter would have brought to that role?
Well, Nell had a very distinctive voice. I mean, the tone was just really like, couldn't mistake her for anyone else. I think she was a better, more experienced actor. Jennifer came up through the church and was a gospel singer. And I never saw Your Arms Too Short to Box with God, but I got the impression that she basically sang in that show. It wasn't like a huge acting performance. So I think also Nell was a great comedian. which Jennifer is not. So I think that would have brought a different color to Effie, you know.
Now, can we talk a little bit about how Michael Bennett, the, you know, golden boy of Broadway at this point because of A Chorus Line, how did he get involved with this particular project?
Tom Ion knew Robin Wagner, who ended up designing the sets. Robin was on the board of the Public Theater. He brought it to Joe Papp, and also Robin had done the sets for A Chorus Line. So he was sort of the link, I think, that got Michael involved in this.
What do you think appealed to Michael Bennett about this particular show?
Oh, you know, Michael loved showbiz, and this had it all, the flash, the music. I mean, in fact, his concept for the show was that everything would take place in a showbiz context. There are no scenes, you know. I always felt in Act Two, it would have been great if Dina's mother died and they all had to reconnect at her funeral because they were all close to her. But Michael wanted everything in a showbiz context.
So everything's taking place on stages and dressing rooms.
Exactly. Nightclubs. It's all in the context of some kind of performance, basically, even though there are backstage scenes and, you know.
But all in that world.
Right.
And do I understand correctly that Tom Ion was supposed to direct it originally?
Oh, he wanted to direct. He was like the writer director. Then when Michael came in, they were co-directing for a while, and they were at loggerheads a lot, apparently. I mean, they were both fairly high strung personalities. And then at one point, I think Michael said, no, I want to direct this. Also, the money, of course, wanted to go with Michael because they were, as these workshops developed, they brought in the Schuberts. They brought in David Geffen to see it. And they were all like, well, Michael has to direct this. Michael was very involved at that point with Chorus Line productions around the world. And he brought in a co-choreographer, Michael Phillips. Is that right?
Is it Michael Peters?
Michael Peters. That's it. I'm sorry. Brought in Michael Peters, who was African-American. And I think that balance worked out really well.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Have you heard any stories about what it was like to work with Michael Bennett?
Oh, yes.
would you share some? We've heard some others. So would you share what that experience was like, this visionary individual?
Well, he was visionary. Not particularly nice, I would say. And he was driven. I mean, he just was a bulldozer that would sort of, you know, roll over anyone. Henry liked working with him a lot, but other people did find him very difficult.
And, you know, one of the things that you mentioned, and it's so ironic, is that he had such a cinematic eye when it came to directing, but yet he never directed any movies himself.
No, just didn't happen.
What do you think his film work would have been like had he lived long enough to achieve that?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I can see, because he did have such a cinematic sensibility, I could see him making that transition like Bob Fosse did. I mean, I think he did have a very strong visual sense, for one thing.
I've always been surprised that he wasn't able to direct the Chorus Line movie, or would have been a little different, or to have brought Dreamgirls to the screen, which eventually it came to, and we'll talk about that in a second.
Right.
One of the things that you mentioned in your chapter, which I thought was such an interesting observation, was that there was an insistence from the creative team that the ladies that are cast as the Dreams are darker skinned African-American performers as opposed to lighter skinned African-American performers. Can you talk a little about that and why that occurred?
Well, Tom Ion from the first was really set on that. And I think that was really brave, because the crossover of African-Americans tended to be the lighter you were, the more likely that was to happen. And to be palatable to white audiences, supposedly, was the idea. But Tom really insisted on casting darker women. And that was revolutionary.
One of the, in the past, you know, 40 years or so, musical theater rarely moves over into the pop charts. And I'm Telling You I'm Not Going is one of those rare occurrences. Can you tell us the origin story of And I'm Telling You I'm Not Going? Because I had no idea this was even a thing until I read your chapter.
Right. Well, Henry, I think Tom had written the lyric, and Henry was struggling with it a bit. And they were in 890 Broadway Studios, which was a building near Union Square in New York City that Michael had purchased after the success of Chorus Line. And it was full of rehearsal studios, and it was, he had his offices there. Robin Wagner had his office there. It was a real beehive of creativity. And so Henry, though, they knew they wanted a song for Effie, and he was having trouble with it. He always writes from the lyric first, or almost always. And he was in one of the rehearsal studios at 890, and Ray Stark, the movie producer, very successful, he had done Funny Girl and many other major films, came into that studio and asked if he could use the phone. And Henry said, sure. And he was wheeling and dealing and, you know, making these Hollywood calls. And he left, and something about that, just hearing all that, really pushed Henry. And he just sat down and basically wrote the song. And he shared a tape with me of him teaching it to Jennifer Holliday for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Which is extraordinary. Because, Henry doesn't read music. I mean, he's an ingenious composer, but he doesn't read music. And I don't think maybe Jennifer does either. So they were just in the room, and he would sing a phrase, and then she would repeat it, and then they would go back and forth like that. It's really fascinating to hear it. It's all there. I mean, it's all there in that first rehearsal.
That is incredible. Oh, to get my hands on that tape, I would be such a happy person.
Okay, now, I'll send it to you.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Thank you, Bill. Listeners, I'll let you know how it turns out. Now, one of the things I found so interesting in your chapter was that, you know, you said that there was a $3.5 million budget for this particular production, making it the most expensive musical to that date. But what's interesting, at least because I never saw the original production, when I look at photographs from the original production, it seems like it's just an empty stage with scaffolding. So I'm curious, where did all that money go?
Well, you know, it looks empty, but or it might look empty in the pictures, but it was a technological breakthrough, that set and lights, because it moved everywhere. So those lights were all remotely controlled, which I don't think had happened at that point a lot. And as I said, they danced, the towers danced, the lights danced. And then there were these bridges which came down that people could stand on, but they had the lights underneath them. And it was stunning to watch. Also, the costumes, I mean, were very expensive. You could see the money on stage.
Got it.
Unlike Chorus Line, which was very, very sparse, you know, there basically it was an empty stage with a white line.
That's fascinating, because there are some people who look at that, you know, that original production, you go, where's the set? But for those of us who've never seen it, we've heard about the towers that danced and the lighting that danced. And right. I think, you know, I know the famous effect of, like you were saying, of Jennifer Holliday, where she was able to change costume without moving a muscle. Right. And I also heard there was a section where the three dreams are wearing one outfit. They walk through a Mylar curtain and come right back again, and they're in a totally different outfit and wigs. Something along those lines. That the costume changes were just...
Oh, they were remarkable, and the costumes were stunning. And I remember a moment where the dreams come out, and there's this wall of lights behind them that was just like, whoa, you know, it was showbiz pizzazz to the nth degree.
Have you ever seen a production of Dreamgirls that did not use Michael Bennett's staging?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the West End production, that was not Michael's staging. The most recent one. Casey Nicola, who directed that and choreographed it. I mean, he certainly was inspired by Michael's production, but it was rethought.
And it still works, right? The show is strong enough that you can have many different interpretations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you're a musical theater aficionado, I would say that probably one of the most, one of the things that'll encourage the most debate is best musical, 1982, Nine versus Dreamgirls.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what was going on with this rivalry?
Well, Michael Riedel, the columnist, theater columnist, has written a wonderful book, Razzle Dazzle, about the history of the Schubert Organization. And the key focus of that is the whole Dreamgirls 9 competition for best musical. There's a couple things that were going on underneath just the shows. One was that the Schuberts had torn down the Marasco and Helen Hayes theaters, and there was an outrage in the theater community about that. So he posits that part of the reason 9 won Best Musical was a backlash against the Schuberts, because 9 was in a Niederlander theater. Mm. I mean, these are the things you don't think about when you see those awards, you know, but that... Also, what's interesting about it is, we were at the opening of 9, and I mean, it was really inventive, but it was also very cold, I felt. And but it opened, Dreamgirls opened in December, and 9 opened the day that Tony eligibility for that season closed in May. And often shows that are closer to the actual Tony Awards win because people, you know them better or whatever. But I think there was all this underlying stuff about the Schuberts that really did hurt Dreamgirls, which ran twice as long as 9 and, you know, has much bigger hits than 9 did.
So regardless of who tore down what theaters, you are happy. Are you not? Would you like to have seen Dreamgirls win?
Oh, absolutely. I think it absolutely deserved Best Musical. And Henry, I'm very prejudiced, but he deserved Best Score. Tom won for best book, but I think Henry and Tom should have won for best score.
And Dreamgirls, like you were saying, has lived on, I mean, much longer than Nine has, through its, it had a very long run, but then there was a very successful film adaptation in the early 2000s. I'm assuming you saw it?
Oh, yes. I'm also connected to the film in a lot of ways because Bill Condon, who directed it, went on to direct the revival of Sideshow. And so I did go to the premiere. Henry and I had a show, Lucky Duck, at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego in 2004. And he and Bill were already working on the movie of Dreamgirls. And Bill came down to San Diego to see the show, and we went out to dinner and everything. So I had met him and then was invited to a screening, actually, of the movie. And I was just blown away by it. I just thought, wow, you know, incredible. He always loved the show, and I thought he really, really nailed it.
Did you find it more impactful on film than you did on stage, or do you feel that both have things that make it impactful regardless of its medium?
I thought both worked really well. I thought he was able to really find cinematic language for it that, you know, really worked. It's often hard to do musicals on film, I think, because it's such a realistic medium, but he really brought it to life.
And going back a little bit to, once again, musical theater controversies and debate, if, you know, 1982 isn't a big one, another big one would be, you know, why didn't they record the entire score of Follies, and why didn't they record the entire score of Dreamgirls? Can you talk a little bit about the original cast recording of Dreamgirls that, even though it went gold, was very different from what people were hearing in the theater?
Right. Well, it's very expensive to do a two album set. This is back when everything was vinyl. And, well, actually, CDs were just coming out then. But double CDs, double albums are expensive and they don't necessarily sell. So David Geffen was one of the original producers of Dreamgirls, and it was his record label that recorded the original cast recording. And it was just really an economic decision. And a lot of fans were outraged because there's so much music in Dreamgirls that's not on that album, because so much of it was sung through. Bill Condon corrected that in the movie. I mean, that's got several releases of the whole movie score, but the movie did cut some songs and trimmed some of the recit.
And once again, listeners, if you've never seen the movie version of Dreamgirls, you should. It's probably one of the greatest movie musicals made in the past 30 years. It's done so brilliantly. Can you tell us a little bit about the show that Henry Krieger followed Dreamgirls with? And that's The Tap Dance Kid, a musical that has sort of faded away over time.
Right. I saw that. And actually, it's going to be done this season at Encores, the series in New York where they do script in hand versions. They're usually much more elaborate than script in hand, but of past musicals. So I'm looking forward to seeing it again because I don't remember it that well. But again, it's about a upper middle class black family. The father's a lawyer, and the young son wants to tap dance. And you know, it's great. It's Henry is so has so many multiple musical worlds within him. It's not like the Dreamgirls score, really. But
that one also, I think, covers in the black experience this idea of, you know, how can you pursue your dreams while not playing into a stereotype of a specific community? because I think that's something that'll be really interesting to explore when it gets revisited, like you said, at Encores in 2022. One of the things I found so fascinating about your chapter was when I was reading it, I came across the show title Big River. And I thought to myself, how does Big River relate to Dreamgirls? And you pointed out an interesting fact that I had no idea about. Can you talk a little bit about why Dreamgirls opened the door to Big River?
Well, because Dreamgirls tapped into that baby boomer music that appealed to baby boomers, I think it made producers think, we need to get to that audience. And so Roger Miller, who was certainly had no relationship to Motown, but was a very popular songwriter with the baby boomers. I think it was Rocco Landisman, the producer, who approached him about doing this version of Huckleberry Finn. And that opened up, that was really pretty much one of the first instances after Dreamgirls of a pop composer writing a score for Broadway. And then that opened, then they did Buddy, based on the Buddy Holly catalog, and that opened the door for all these jukebox musicals where instead of going after the composers of pop hits, they just took the catalog and wrote shows around them. But Dreamgirls to Roger Miller to Elton John writing for the stage, all of that is a pretty interesting progression.
And what do you think, what examples have you seen of a pop composer that can successfully transition to the world of musical theater composition?
Well, Elton John certainly has done that in spades. I mean, Lion King, barely qualified for a Best Score nomination because much of the score had been written for the film, the animated film first, but they decided that over 50% of the Broadway show was original, so he was nominated. So he's been very successful. Sarah Bareilles is having a great success with Waitress. Many pop stars have tried it and not succeeded, but others have.
But you feel that Elton John and Sarah Bareilles understand the theatricality that's needed in order to put a score across.
I think they worked with people who understood. I'm not sure how much they actually understood theater, but they were brought in and started working with people who really did.
We've covered this a little bit, but I'll ask you again, which is, what do you think the impact of Dreamgirls will be going forward now as we move into 2022 and we go forward, especially with, so many discussions about the BIPOC community and all of those issues that are going on? Where do you think Dreamgirls stands in the canon of musical theater?
Well, I think it's a classic and it's iconic, and it opened the door for so many Black performers. And I think that it will continue to. People keep playing Effie and winning awards. Jennifer Hudson won the Oscar. Amber Riley won the Olivier Award. Roles like that are not going to disappear.
And one of the things that it's, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because you'll know this better than I do, but Dreamgirls itself is a musical about a realistic, non-review, contemporary music about the African-American experience. And we really had not had a lot of that prior. Original. We had Raisin, which was based on A Raisin in the Sun, but it seemed to be tons of reviews or fantasies like The Wiz. So this is one of the first Black musicals to be grounded in a reality. Is that correct?
That's true. Yes.
A contemporary one, which, like you were saying, opens the door to so many other wonderful things. Bill, it has been such a pleasure getting to talk to you today about this magnificent show. I wish we had more time to talk about all the wonderful shows that you've done, but they might they might pop up in a future edition of 50 Key Musicals, so don't be all surprised.
Okay.
Are you working on anything right now?
Well, I'm working on some things, but not necessarily musicals. They just, at the moment, they take so long. And of course, the pandemic is just like, we had so many productions of Sideshow that were in rehearsal that, you know, had to be canceled because of the pandemic. So, and I direct quite a lot, and I'm continuing to do that. And I love that. In fact, I hope to be coming over to your neck of the woods for another production of Pageant. So,
oh, that makes me so happy to hear. It's such a wonderful show. It is such a joy. Friends, thank you so much for listening today. Please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about Dreamgirls, please also review the links in the below description. I'm Robert Schneider, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast. Bye-bye. Life's not as bad as it may seem if you open your eyes to what's in front of you.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold.